Welcome to The Virtual Shift, a show looking at the seismic changes happening in healthcare with virtual care at the epicenter. Join me and my guests as we look at key cultural and policy shifts impacting how providers, payers, and patients connect, as well as how care is being reimagined both for today and the future. Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. You can learn more about this show by visiting the program on healthcarenowradio.com, and be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at FoleyTom, and the hashtag, The Virtual Shift. Today, we have a great guest on, Matt Fisher, General Counsel. Matt, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me on. Looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, Matt, you also do a Healthcare Now radio program as well. Can you remind the audience what that program name is?
Yep. So I'm host of Healthcare Du Jour, where, you know, kind of just talk through whatever is a hot or interesting topic in healthcare. So there's really no kind of set specific topic or area within the industry that I talk to guests about. It's really whatever sounds interesting. So, you know, it can be anywhere from IT to mental health to opioids and trying to address those issues to security, privacy, value-based care. So it's a lot of wide-ranging, interesting discussions.
Awesome. And the discussion that we're going to have today, given your legal background, is that we're going to talk about the regulatory and legal aspects of what we can do in virtual care. There's a lot of discussions, as you know, and a lot of noise out there relative to what are the requirements for remote patient monitoring? Who can do what? And the same thing with remote therapeutic monitoring and the same thing with chronic care management. So today's the conversation is really going to kind of walk through each one of those platforms, if you will, and talk about the roles and responsibilities of both the provider and or the software platform that one licenses, right? And then ultimately, if a provider wants to elect to have a third party provide some of those services, is that permissible? So let's talk about remote patient monitoring first. Remote patient monitoring has five different CPT codes. 99453 is about the onboarding process. Then you have 99454. That's the distribution of the medical device and the capturing of 16 unique vitals 16 days out of a 30-day period. Is that accurate?
Yep. No, you still need to do that minimum of 16 recordings in the period. So it's, you know, I know there's been questions of trying to get that changed. And I believe within the past year or two, CMS had posed that question within the proposed physician fee schedule. Ultimately, didn't include any change, but certainly seems to be something they're looking at because, you know, some folks might remember, you know, actually, I guess it's technically still in effect, you know, as we're recording in early June 2022, due to the public health emergency waivers from COVID, you know, if you're doing monitoring related to COVID, then you can get down to just two readings in that either 30-day period or calendar month period, depending on which code you're looking at. But I think the safe one is, as you had said, get the 16 minimum, and then you're not going to have any questions.
Exactly. So now we shift over to 99457 and 458, right? Each one of them, really, 99457 is about the actual engagement of the patient and the monitoring of the patient, right? I got all these vital information flowing from 99454, but now, you know, what do I do with that data? And this is where the confusion might come in, or maybe some physicians are not as aware as they should be as to what the possibilities are. Point there being is the physician might say, remote patient monitoring, oh my God, I gotta watch all those alerts. I can't do that. I'm on this hamster wheel of 25, 30 patients a day in my practice. I don't have time to look at those alerts. But that's not necessarily true. Is that correct?
Yep. No, that's definitely correct. You know, those 457, 458 codes can be done under supervision. You know, so that means you can either delegate other staff within your office, or, you know, if you're contracting with an outside service provider, whether it be a technology company with a managed service wing or just a managed service company, you know, you can delegate the performance of the actual remote monitoring services to an eligible clinician there. You know, which can be a variety of folks. It doesn't have to be someone that can actually bill Medicare, because I think maybe we should have level set it up front. But, you know, I think most of the discussion we'll have is around the Medicare requirements for RPM and RTM and CCM, understanding that, you know, Medicaid will cover it in certain states as well as commercial insurers, you know, but on the whole, they'll follow the Medicare requirements. But yeah, back to that supervision piece, the physician can have an MA or a PA providing, for example, providing the actual remote monitoring services. But then once that delegated service occurs, the bill will still typically go out under the physician or the NP or whoever else is eligible under the RPM requirements to actually be able to bill Medicare for a service. But at the end of the day, it's someone who has the ability to bill Medicare is the one in whose name and MPI it has to go out under. And then kind of one other point that I think we kind of skipped past quickly on the device side. So on the 454 code that we were talking about a minute ago, and this is a question that I hear a lot is, don't I need an actual FDA approved device to be able to do the remote monitoring? And when you look at the requirements, and this is actually made fairly clear in, I think it was the 2021 physician fee schedule that CMS published, it just has to be a device that meets the definition of a medical device as defined by the FDA. It doesn't have to be an FDA approved device, which is a very important distinction.
Well, it doesn't need to be 510K cleared, is what you're saying, from an FDA perspective, which would be a true medical device from an FDA perspective.
Correct. Yeah. So kind of one of the prime examples I use is, you know, general wearables like an Apple Watch or, you know, a Garmin or Fitbit or any of those ones that are on the market. You know, if that thing is collecting some type of health related information that justify or is the type of information that the ordering clinician wants for the RPM service, you know, that can be used. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be, as you said, a 510K cleared device or any other officially approved device from the FDA.
So what would you say to the physician that says, yeah, but those devices aren't medical devices? They might collect a vital, right? Like a 510K cleared device would collect a vital, but they're not accurate, hypothetically. So they haven't gone through the process of validating whether or not they're measuring a vital accurately enough. So should I be relying on a device that doesn't do it accurately or a device that does that accurately? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where it comes down to the medical judgment of that clinician who's ordering the service. Because ultimately, you know, to be able to order any service that you're going to bill to Medicare, it has to be deemed medically necessary, which is a judgment call that's being made by that ordering clinician, so the physician in this case. If your hypothetical physician doesn't trust the data from, you know, an Apple Watch, say, then they'll probably say, okay, let's find a different device that's going to be able to collect information that I feel I can trust when it comes to the particular monitoring that I'm looking for. But even then, even if you have a clear device, you might still have clinicians questioning the accuracy. You know, I feel like a blood pressure cuff is one of the best examples of that. You know, just hearing concerns raised by, you know, folks that I work with, it's, you know, we can say, hey, this device is an approved device. It's gone through testing and all this. And the clinician will still say, I still don't think it's reading quite accurately. You know, I think that's starting to get better, you know, as the devices and the companies producing them get more experience. But, you know, I think kind of over, to me, that is more related to a potential hesitancy around using virtual care and is having to get beyond saying, well, I have to have my hands on someone and I have to be the one doing the reading to trust that it's accurate.
Yeah. So thanks for stepping us back on that. That was very important relative to getting it right. So if you don't mind, let's go back to 99457 and 458. Each one of those billable codes, you can bill up to 1 hour of monitoring services in 20-minute segments, right? 99457 is 20 minutes. And then you can bill 99458 twice, each for 20-minute segments. Is that accurate?
Yep. Yeah. Because once you start getting beyond that 60-minute period, then you're going to get into, you know, well, I guess if you have multiple conditions, potentially into CCM, you know, chronic care management, which I know we'll get to in a little bit. Or, you know, if you're a specialist, maybe it's principal care management, you know, because there's a whole host of all these monitoring codes that have popped up. But, you know, you are kind of looking at the severity. And if it's requiring beyond that hour's worth of time, then, as I said, maybe you fall into a different code set, which is also going to impact the amount of reimbursement you get. You know, because unfortunately, you know, working off of the 2022 fee schedule right now, you know, CCM got a pretty significant bump up, whereas RPM had the reimbursement fall. You know, kind of goes contrary to the trends since Medicare had recognized RPM as billable codes. But you do want to be looking at that. And, as you're pointing out, also, it's, you know, each one of those is a 20-minute chunk. So you have to fill that full 20-minute chunk to be able to bill for it. You know, so if you only get 19 minutes, you're not going to qualify for the code. But you also don't have to necessarily do it all at once. You don't have to sit there and do 20 minutes, you know, all at one time. You can
it's over a 30-day period, correct?
Yeah. So for 457 and 458, hopefully I'm not going to get this wrong, but that is over the, I believe, a calendar month. So you're like, so 457 and 458 are the calendar month. 453, 454 are a 30-day period. And those are specifically set out within the description of the CPT code, which obviously generates confusion because, you know, you'll have someone say, well, I started the RPM, say, on the 13th of a month. You know, maybe you didn't get 16 readings before the end of that calendar month, but then you get it before a 30-day period runs. You'll be able to bill different codes. You know, so it definitely creates, you know, a necessity to pay attention to the detail of what you're doing. And then the other thing that I think is also very important when you're looking at the 20-minute chunks under 457 and 458 are, you know, what are the types of services that qualify? Because again, this got clarification recently as well. You know, there used to be the feeling that there had to be 20 minutes of actual, you know, face-to-face, you know, whether in person or some type of virtual interactive communication with the patient to actually qualify for it. But now it's clearer that no, you can combine that type of interactive communication time along with review of the data that are coming in. I know some people have suggested, well, given that kind of flexibility, do I need any do I need any type of a visit with the patient? You know, my view on it is the way the regulation and the guidance was written, it says, you know, interactive communication time as well as the review of the data. So, you know, I take that as well as to mean you need both. You know, there's no minimum amount of that interactive time, but, you know, my feeling is you definitely need some of it to be able to justify the billing of the codes.
Yeah. So, and that time is about, fundamentally, as I look at it, you tell me differently, is about ensuring and engaging that patient to make sure that they're getting the 16 measures in that month, right? So if I'm noticing that this patient is short, coming up to be short on their measures, it's really about engaging them over the period of that 30 days, that calendar month, to ultimately help them maximize their collection of the vitals and stabilization of their wellness. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that is fair, that a part of it will certainly be, you know, the nudging and the reminding the patient, but it could also be, you know, as you're starting to collect that data throughout the billable period, maybe you're starting to see trends or you're starting to see other issues that call for some type of a quick intervention. You know, because, you know, what I've seen is and heard reported back from folks who are doing RPM style services is instead of seeing something and waiting until the end of the period and having the patient come in, you know, a quick phone call or a quick video visit can actually make a much more immediate and significant impact by being able to identify a cause or recommend a change in behavior that can produce immediate benefits.
Yes, some great points there. So for remote patient monitoring, 499457 and 458, if you're noticing a person with glucose, as an example, a person with diabetes, and you know they could be in range, if you will, right, throughout that 30-day period. But if you're seeing an upward slope or a downward slope, you know, there's something that you need to intercept there. So it's not just about making sure that they're within the range. You could have used some AI or some just visual observation of charting that says, hey, I can intercept this problem to mitigate an ED visit or a need for an official physician visit. Thoughts?
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's why, you know, my view, I really view kind of RPM and CCM and all these monitoring codes as, you know, certainly driving additional fee-for-service revenue currently, where, you know, you still have the majority of groups across the country relying on fee-for-service as their primary reimbursement methodology. But it's also, you know, inherently training the folks who are using those types of modalities to be prepared and shifting their style of practice to succeed when you move into a more value-based system where, you know, kind of as you just suggested, the whole point is spot things before they become really problematic and help folks maintain their health proactively as opposed to just being reactive. You know, so as you said, if you can see that data trending, whether it's being filtered through an AI or other analytics capability, or you're just, you know, manually going in and seeing it, if you can then get in there and make that call to the patient or do some type of, you know, maybe sometimes it's just pushing educational materials over to them or doing something where you're not just waiting for a predetermined period or date at the end of a window, then you're going to drive better health, better outcomes. And it's, you know, as I said, why I really think that, you know, these types of virtual care modalities are preparing and laying the foundation for success with value-based care in the future.
So one more element of remote patient monitoring, and then we'll move on to the next category. So there's this, the original code for remote patient monitoring, 99091, is still able to be billed. Guide the audience here about why, given the current CPT codes for remote patient monitoring, 99091 is still valid from a billable perspective.
Yeah, so kind of as you're suggesting, that was the original code that was out there. It's arguably a little bit less precise and less specifically geared to RPM, but certainly can layer into it. I think the primary difference is it's looking at the actual time or looking at time spent by the actual ordering clinician. So that's 99091 is one of the is the one code that cannot be delegated. You can't ask someone else to perform it. That's also why it remains important, because it's, you probably still want that physician who's ordering or that MP who's ordering it to be involved in the care. So this, if they're spending the appropriate amount of time, this is going to recognize and reimburse them for that time that is spent. And then it also goes into kind of that plan development and why are we using RPM in a particular instance. So again, those are, that's kind of where you start to see the distinctions out from 457 and 458. Again, keys are you actually need the ordering clinician to be the one doing it, and it does take a little bit more time. So it's beyond that 20 minutes, it's 30, 40 minutes. So it does take a little bit of investment. But if you're thinking about it, having that clinician take that time to do it and then justify why they're ordering the RPM, it just helps kind of do almost a CYA to some degree in terms of being able to document the medical necessity of why you've initiated RPM in the first case.
Interesting. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Virtual Shift. My name is Tom Foley. I'm your host. Our guest here today is Matt Fisher. He is a general counsel, and we're talking about the regulatory aspects of remote patient monitoring, remote therapeutic monitoring, and chronic care management. Let's move, Matt, to remote therapeutic monitoring. The model is very similar to remote patient monitoring, but I think that there are some distinctions as to what the provider can delegate, if you will. Can you kind of give us that outline?
Yeah, no. So as you said, the baseline is RTM is almost identically modeled off of RPM, certainly in terms of what the codes are, what the reimbursement amounts are. The difference is that as recognized by CMS in the fee schedule this year, because it's RTM is brand new for this current fiscal year of Medicare, the goal was to try and get folks like physical therapists and nurses to be the ones primarily delivering it, because it was understood that this is going to be a slightly different service than RPM. Because you can have different categories of clinicians initiating it and billing for it, though, the supervision changes. Because delegation and supervision, like we're talking about for RPM, under the Medicare regulations is very much geared, this isn't wholly accurate, but it's easiest to kind of just say it's really just geared towards physicians being the supervisor. So PT, for example, can't delegate and supervise someone that's not on their staff. So what is kind of the models that I've seen pop up where for RTM, if you've got an outside company coming in, one potential model would be is you have to look at who your customer is going to be. So if your customer is a physician doing the RTM, then you can probably still rely on delegated supervision similar to RPM. But if you have a physical therapist wanting to initiate the RTM, what you might end up having to do is, on the outside, lease your staff over. So the physical therapist can treat those people as, kind of temporary employees under them. And then you can be able to delegate down to a physical therapy. I think it's associate or assistant is the technical term for the person who can do it. So you have to be looking at those nuances. Another difference is, and we kind of forgot to talk about this with RPM, but when we were talking about the devices and the collection of data in RPM, the data has to be collected and transmitted automatically by the device. Manual entry by the patient is not permitted.
That's under RPM, right? Automated transfer is RPM, and then RTM has a different criteria. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, no, correct. I think as you're trying to make sure, we want to make clear that the automatic transmission is remote patient monitoring. Manual entry is allowable under remote therapeutic monitoring. And that makes sense because with RTM, so the remote therapeutic monitoring, you're looking at conditions or trying to track the behaviors that aren't necessarily going to be capable of being collected automatically or collected electronically and then automatically transmitted, like maybe medication adherence, some of the examples are use of an inhaler. While yes, I understand that there are connectable inhalers that are out there, it's probably much more common that someone gets their basic inhaler where you pick it up, you spray it in your nose and or in your mouth, and it helps you. And then recognizing that that's probably the more common way of seeing it, remote therapeutic monitoring allows the patient to then record that to demonstrate the adherence.
So, and under remote therapeutic monitoring, we're not measuring vitals per se. We're measuring muscle skeletal or neurological conditions such as and medication adherence, right? If your pain management, if you have a valid pain scale, what's your pain level today, right? Very subjective to some degree. A patient can say my pain level today is 5. But then you can see that charted over time and really start to see that picture. But at the same time, did you take your meds today, right? Yes or no. And so doing an automated assessment, and then you can overlay your medication adherence to your vitals, hypothetically, right? If you're a diabetic, did you take your drug therapy, and are you dieting and exercising? So there's a lot of different ways in which you could combine those two to kind of tell the bigger story of that patient. Fair enough?
Yeah, no, I like that description of it. And it's also probably raises another important point is, you know, when we're talking about RPM, we keep calling it remote patient monitoring. But if you actually go with the technical phrase for it, Medicare or CMS actually calls it remote physiologic monitoring. I'm not quite sure why, because everyone colloquially certainly calls it remote patient monitoring.
What are you going to do with CMS?
Yeah, you know, maybe it's better to just say remote patient monitoring is the broad category that covers all of it, because that's probably the better way to think about it. And then, you know, remote physiologic is the automatically collected data. The remote therapeutic is, as you said, you know, the type of information that's going to be more self-reported. You know, nothing like healthcare to generate overlapping terms where you've got all these concentric circles and no one's clear on which is the outermost circle.
I don't know what you're talking about, healthcare having overlapping terms. All right. I won't get into the details, more details of remote patient monitoring, but the billing codes are very much the same, and including the 20-minute segments of monitoring, right? You have 98977 and 98988. And the important distinction that you made with RPM is that if your client who's providing the service is a provider, then that provider can still delegate the services to a partner, if you will, to provide that monitoring service on their behalf. If you're a therapist or a nurse, to your point, you have to look at it a little differently in how you lease your resources to that practice so that that service can be done in that context. Is that still an accurate summary of your point?
Yes. Yeah. No. So as you just pointed out, you know, RTM has a lot more nuance to it. You know, the other complication with it is, you know, as I said, since it's only new this year, at least from my perspective, there's extremely short shrift given to the expectations for it within the physician fee schedule where it was adopted. You know, I think if I'm recalling correctly, it amounted to maybe like 3 to 4 pages or so of the Federal Register. Understanding that that becomes wicked small font and triple columned, it's still not that much. You know, and that's saying something because I also feel like there's extremely little guidance when it comes to RPM on the whole. You know, because even though that's been around for 5 or so years at this point and it gets tweaked around almost every year, there's still not a ton of specifics once you start adding up all the statements that are contained within the fee schedule. So I'm not going to say I'm optimistic that CMS will be more specific and provide more black and white guidelines, because it's, I'll say it, government perspective might be, it's, you know, if we keep it a little bit vaguer and shadier, there's more opportunity to question how things are done after the fact. Maybe trying to be a little bit more optimistic, the fairer perspective would be is we're all trying to figure this out together. So, you know, as people adopt it and utilize it, submit comments to CMS so they can help guide and frame what they're doing in the future. If I'm trying to be really fair, it's probably a little bit of both. And it's, you know, which would certainly not be uncommon with CMS's approach to a lot of different programs that it administers.
So let's jump to chronic care management. There's 3 primary codes that I'll reference, and there's many others, as you know, right? So you have 99490, you have 99439, and 99491 are the 3. Now, similar to RPM, RTM, just from a perspective of if I'm a provider and I want to provide this virtual care service and maybe bundle all 3 together, all to a single patient because they have 2 or more chronic conditions, which is the minimum criteria So they have two or more chronic conditions. So can I still delegate the service, or is 491 excluded from that delegation?
Yeah, no, so there's still delegation possible with CCM. You know, then the other, you know, kind of the main thing with CCM also is, you know, I know this, as you said, there's the whole host of codes, but it's kind of broken into regular CCM and then complex, you know, because you do have with the basic CCM codes, time limitations, you know, again, that's up to an hour. And then if you're going to exceed the hour, then you're going to kick into complex. You know, and the important reason, again, for tracking that one is because the reimbursement changes, you know, as maybe would not be unexpected, the complex gets you a bit more money.
When you talk about complex CCM, are you talking about the CPT codes 99487 and 489?
Yes. Yeah.
So I just wanted to get that perspective. Now, the chronic care management program is two or more chronic conditions thought to be on a long-term 12 months or more program. This is the general criteria. The provider can still delegate the engagement of chronic care management. You know, so there's a care plan involved here. So it's not just about, hey, did I get your vitals today? Or, hey, what was your pain level today? Or, did you have an appointment? Did you get to the appointment? Do you need some assistance? You know, did you exercise? There's a whole care plan that this care team that's acting on behalf of the provider needs to engage that patient to really maximize their better state of wellness. Is that a fair summary of how these three fuse together?
Yes. Yeah. Because as you know, as you're just pointing out, the care plan, you know, has a lot more detail and a lot more specific detail that needs to go into it. You know, and then also, you know, CCM has kind of follow-on requirements around coordination of care, the ability to access the care plan, you know, have that care plan communicated to other clinicians involved in that patient's care, the certified EHR use, you know, so there, when you're looking at the CCM requirements, it is a bit more prescribed than what you see for both RPM and RTM. And then also, as you pointed out, Tom, it's, you know, a longer time frame, you know, because you are looking at an extended period of time in the, you know, the chronic conditions. While CMS doesn't have a specific list of conditions that, you know, or a limited list that qualifies, you know, there are references to certain conditions or certain listings of conditions, but it, you know, they're very clear that it's not exclusive. You do need at least two of them, and they have to also have, you know, be conditions that are posing serious health risks to the patient. You know, so it's not something that's going to be a light complication to their daily living and their daily life. It, you know, they are looking for, you know, issues that are having a pretty significant impact on an individual.
Hey, Matt, this half hour went by real quick. Very informative. I really do think that it clears the air on many different fronts to talk about these matters. And maybe we can have you on again. Thanks again, Matt Fisher, General Counsel. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me on. And, you know, as expected, it was a great conversation. We had a great time with it.
I want to thank the show sponsors, HP. HP Engage Long Lifecycle Products provides the stability, safety, and security you need, plus flexibility and performance designed for today and tomorrow. As well, GenieMD, providing a modular, scalable, and customizable virtual care platform and clinical services to help providers extend care into the home, increasing access and quality while driving new revenue opportunities. If you missed part of today's episode, you can tune in at the same time, 11 a.m. or 7 p.m. Eastern, throughout the week, and be sure to check out the program page on healthcarenowradio.com. And remember, connect or follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I'm Tom Foley. Until the next shift.